From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linscombe here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello, Max. Good to be back. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, I'm Aaron from longform.org. That's Evan Ratliff, formerly of The Atavist, currently performing journalism.
You're really committed to re-identify yourself every time now. Is that
I'm just gonna say, like, we said we were gonna do it last week. Let's keep it alive for like half a week more. Like at least a half-hearted attempt here.
Great. Well, I am Max. I'm from the website longform.org, which we recently posted our Best of the Year series. And I am the one who conducted the interview this week. And it was with Ed Yong.
Who was on our Best of the Year list.
He certainly was. I talked to Ed, faithful listeners will remember, back in March, right at the beginning of the pandemic. He had just written this piece called How the Pandemic Will End that had felt like the first sort of bird's eye view of this thing that made any sense. And he has gone on to publish an incredible amount this year. He's written 8 big feature stories, multiple cover stories for The Atlantic, looking at the pandemic from all of these different angles. He's broken a fair amount of news, particularly around long haulers, who are people who have had COVID symptoms and complications for months and months and months. And so we talked about what this year has been like for him to be covering this thing so relentlessly, the toll that that's taken on him, what he has learned about himself, what he's learned about America. It's our last episode of the year, and it felt like checking in with Ed again was the good was the right way to finish things out.
We have been brought to you all year by the good people at MailChimp. Their support makes this show possible. Thanks to them. Thanks to everyone for listening all year. We don't thank the listeners enough. Thanks to the listeners. Thanks to everyone who sent us an email all year. I feel like we've gotten more mail during the pandemic than ever. So thanks to all the emailers during the pandemic.
And now here's Max with Ed Yong.
You know, I was thinking the other day that, you know how when like two people walk down a corridor at each other and like one of you steps right and the other person accidentally steps the same direction, and you're both like, oh, 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 oh. It feels like every interview I do now begins with like some version of that dance as you both like try and negotiate the usual pleasantries, but also recognize that everything is shit.
Yeah. I feel like that just that question of like, how are you doing has become this like ink blotter test or something, you know, where it's like
right
8 out of 10 times, something like that. I feel like people are like, oh, good, you know.
Yeah.
And then like and then 20% of the time it's just like, I'm fucking terrible, clearly,
right?
Clearly I'm terrible.
Yep.
This is a hellscape. How else could I possibly be, you know? Just like, yep, they just, yep, can't hold it back, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you doing this again, man. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. I mean, twice in one year, my God.
Well, it felt like your year, kind of. Or it was a year that you were in a unique position to try and sum up.
Yeah, it has been something, that's for sure. It has been a very different year than what I thought it was going to be this time last year.
I wrote to you and asked you to come back on, and it's very rare, I think, that we've had someone on twice in the same year. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think about why I asked you to come back on, which maybe is, you could argue, something I should have figured out before I asked. But
was it the bribe?
Yes, yeah. It was Jeffrey Goldberg playing me under the table.
Right.
No, man, I think there are a couple of things. But one of them is, I think I really genuinely wanted to know how you were doing.
Well, I have been better. How do I answer this question? Look, on one hand, it has been, by some margin, the most professionally fulfilling year of my life. I feel like the work I've done has been just so much more ambitious in scope and better in craft than a lot of what I've done before. I think that I feel proud of it. I think it really has contributed to this very difficult moment in time. And, you know, we can talk about specifics of that. So I feel very proud of the work. I feel really privileged to, I think I said this the last time we chatted, to have a role that offers a very clear way of helping out mm-hmm. in this big moment of societal turmoil. Like, the role and the responsibility is very clear. And on the other hand, though, it's been very, very draining. The work is, you know, not as demanding as, say, an ICU nurse's job. But I think that it has been very difficult to just stare directly into the sun for 9 months. And I am burned out. The urgency of the moment and the high stakes of the moment massively exacerbate the usual pressures I would feel about getting things right, making sure that the pieces are nuanced, making sure that I'm really grasping the full complexity of what I'm writing about. Usually I have to do that about a very specific focused thing in the area of science that I have some experience of covering. And now I'm having to do that with this very, very complicated omni-crisis that, you know, feels like it's changing constantly. I am trying to give readers a platform that they can stand to observe this raging torrent that is the pandemic, this cascade of information that is threatening to sweep us all away. You know, I'm trying to give people like a rock on which they can stand so that they can observe what is happening without themselves being submerged by it. But like, I am trying to construct that platform right. while also being submerged in
right.
it. And I'm also really struck by a thing that someone who works in preparedness told me that, so combine two things. So Jeff, our editor-in-chief, has said that magazine writing is very good at looking at the past and at the future, whereas like newspaper writing tends to be very focused on the present. And I think that's right. And preparedness, the work of preparedness is actually very similar to that. So you're constantly looking at your historical vulnerabilities, and you're also looking at where you're going to be vulnerable, like 3 or 4 or 5 steps ahead into the future. So it's not just doing the like lateral looking work mm-hmm. of trying to look at all these areas of society, but also looking like back in time to how we got to this place and then how we're going to end up several years from now. And it's just like intellectually exhausting. Even before you think about the stakes of it, like the emotional burden of having to write about something where a lot of people deem to be a hoax.
Right. It's not just like you were like building a rock in Whitewater Rapids, but like people were walking by the rapids and being like, that's a placid lake you're standing in.
Right. or like having read a raft building manual for the last 2 hours, I'm going to criticize the raft that you're building. It looks wrong to me.
Well, I want to stay here for a second in how you actually build the thing, because it did feel to me, I mean, you and I talked after your first piece in March, and it did feel to me like these big swings you took throughout the year, they felt the way that I think you intended them to feel. Like, they would come and I would be like, oh, now I'm going to understand this better. Because I was, like everyone else, just struggling to navigate the Whitewater Rapids of information about COVID all year. And I was trying to think about like analogous pieces of journalism, like rock in whitewater rafting stuff. And it reminded me of like the giant pool of money,
mm-hmm.
the Alex Bloomberg piece during the financial crash. It was like the first time I understood subprime mortgages really, you know?
Right.
And it was like while that was happening and zoomed out. And I feel like you did it like four times or five times over the course of this year. And I just, I don't know how you build that many rafts.
I also don't know. So since I came back from book leave in mid-March, I have written 21 pandemic stories that have all but one been more than 2,000 words, and eight of which have been at the sort of 5,000 to 8,000 word mark.
So I was underselling you with your five rafts.
Right, that's right. It's a lot of rafts. The final one is being edited right now, and that should come out between Christmas and New Year. But yeah, there's a lot of them. And we talked the last time about the fact that I was given this specific mandate to take big swings by the Atlantic. And that has very much been part of my mindset throughout this entire year. I've tried repeatedly to almost second guess the zeitgeist, to think like two steps ahead and try and like answer the question that was already beginning to be on everyone's minds. And maybe they didn't even realize that's what they were asking. So, you know, obviously the first one was, how will the pandemic end? And then there were others like, why is all of this so confusing? And like, why is what I'm experiencing so different to what I'm seeing on the news?
Mm-hmm.
Or like, how did it come to this? The first big cover story I did, or why do we seem to be stuck in circles? That was the one I wrote about the pandemic spiral that we're all trapped in. So a lot of this was a very deliberate attempt to not get sucked into the business of doing daily piecemeal stories about whatever new thing was happening at the time, but to really try and zoom out and to continue giving people that very broad, very overarching look that helped to ground them in the current moment, but also connected what was happening around them to like the big arc of history.
Mm-hmm.
All of the US's historical inequities, how we've thought about disease and pandemics and preparedness, and how we think about healthcare and, you know, the social determinants of health, all of that stuff. And then, you know, constantly trying to remind people about the fact that more pandemics are likely in the future. The consequences of this one will be very long term. So, yeah, back in time, back and then ahead to the future.
You're saying it sort of casually, Ed, but what you're describing seems incredibly hard to me. Like, you're in this whitewater rapids of information. I assume you're talking to experts and scientists and policy people constantly, talking to frontline workers and healthcare workers constantly. Like, you are in the vortex of this thing. How do you do the work of zooming out to think about what those big questions that people who are so far from that level of information are asking? Like, that seems quite hard to me.
Yeah, it was it was not easy. I was a bit surprised at how generative the work was. Like, the more I did this, the easier it was to find the next thing. Like, I tried to over-report every one of these big stories that I did. So, you know, everyone I'm talking to, maybe 30 to 40 different sources, maybe of whom somewhere like 20 get actually quoted in the story. So there's always like more material that I'm thinking about and dwelling on. And the Atlantic does have a very generative culture. We have a very, very busy Slack room where we talked about the pandemic and all the kinds of different angles about it throughout the year. It's very collaborative. People are constantly bouncing ideas off each other, asking questions, sharing links to important things. You know, I've heard so many stories from really dysfunctional newsrooms where people are hyper competitive and really trying to carve out their own like micro beats in this big story. And I think we try and help each other. And that makes a monumental difference to our ability to spot like the bigger ideas. But so then the other point I wanted to touch on was that this is partly why this year has been so draining and this work has been so draining. Like, I can't pull out of this.
I'm constantly submerged in coronavirus news. I'm looking at what people are saying. I'm thinking about the subjects of past interviews. You know, some of the ideas, whether I like it or not, are just kind of swirling about in my own head. And I was talking to Liz Neely, my wife, about partly why some of these pieces have been so difficult to write, like much more so than some of the other big stories or features that I've tackled in the past. And I think that, as she pointed out, that to a degree, some of these features are much more akin to like a master's thesis than a typical magazine story. There is a process of organizing and generating knowledge that isn't just like pure reportage. You know, some of the pieces I wrote about why the coronavirus is so confusing or why we're trapped in a pandemic spiral, that really involved like looking at a huge number of different trends and actually trying to organize them into some sort of coherent scholastic framework, like a multi-part analysis of how we got to this point. And I think Liz's point feels right, that there is a sort of extra layer of like shaping our understanding of this moment that I think has added to the complexity of the writing. I can't remember whether I said this the last time we talked, but I've never tried so hard to be right about something while also desperately hoping to be wrong. You know, I want these pieces to stand the test of time. I don't want to write work in this moment that is going to be relevant like today and then be immediately out of date tomorrow. Part of this idea of creating these like platforms for people to stand on and feel some stability is that those platforms have to be as timeless as possible in a changing moment like this. Doing the platform work is useless if the platform erodes within a week. So there is a process of trying to sort of anticipate and future-proof the work.
Right.
That also adds to the challenge of doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting going back and reading like How the Pandemic Will End, which came out in March. And, you know, the platform is still very solid, but there would just be like these occasional lines that were really about what the White House was going to do.
Totally.
That are just like, oh, that board in the platform is missing. You know, it's just like...
Yeah, it is really interesting looking back at it, because I think like, I'm proud of that piece. I think it still holds up 9 months later, despite everything. You know, there's a few things that I think I was both too pessimistic and too optimistic. I think we actually ended up doing pretty well on ventilators in particular.
Yeah.
That's great. I think I massively overestimated the effect that having intransigent politicians actually catch the virus themselves might have. And then there are things that I think have been crucial components of the pandemic story, which are not really mentioned in that March piece. The racial inequalities is a very obvious one, which I think I started writing about in April. And I think some of that only really became clear when the racial data first came out in April, but I think was abundantly obvious and predictable to anyone who had any expertise in health inequalities before then.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
One of the things for me that has been so striking about this year and what this virus has done is it feels to me like it has, if there was shit, it's exposed it. You know, family life, friends, work, and then much larger societal things. Like if there was stuff, it's been exposed. And I wonder what you feel like the virus has exposed.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that has been a running theme of much of the work that I've done this year. So just take the two cover stories that I wrote for The Atlantic. The first one about how the pandemic defeated America, which came out in August, was really about all of those pre-existing weaknesses. In that piece, I argued that the reason America has mishandled the pandemic so badly was not just to do with Donald Trump, although obviously he is a central factor, but that it had a multitude of vulnerabilities. You know, it tore apart inequities that have been lingering since the very founding of this country. It exploited the understaffed nursing home system. It exploited the overstuffed prison system. It exposed our catastrophic underfunding of public health. And I think it exposed a lot of America's exceptionalism and hubris. You know, this was the country that supposedly was going to do better at a pandemic than any other nation, a prediction which now seems absolutely laughable in hindsight. So there were all these problems. There were problems about our distrust of expertise, our use of social media platforms that act as radicalization engines. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump, who has a sort of unique place here because he is both a catalyst for this crisis, but also a symptom of a lot of these problems that precede him. And then in the most recent cover story, this one about how the world of science was shaken up and reacted to the pandemic, the themes are actually very similar. In many ways, scientists have really risen to the occasion and pulled off amazing feats, not least of which was the creation of at least two effective vaccines in an extremely short amount of time. But science has also struggled in many ways this year. There's been a lot of shoddy work, either because of a lack of coordination or because people who didn't have expertise in new areas rushed into them because of the allure of prestige and contributed to work that reinvented the wheel or wasn't very good and that led to misleading messages rather than actually helpful ones. All of these effects were the result of the way science had been built well before 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, the vaccines are the product of investments in mRNA technology that well preceded the rise of SARS-CoV-2. A lot of the problems and the successes have stemmed from innovations in sharing scientific knowledge, in publishing papers early, in making the whole scientific process more transparent. And all of this is affected by academic incentives, which rather than rewarding people for doing the most rigorous possible work, actually just reward people for publishing a ton of papers in prestigious journals. And those incentives naturally push scientists towards smaller, more piecemeal, less rigorous work. And that's not to say that, like, everyone does that. Many people are capable of resisting it, but that pull remains. And it became even harder and stronger during the pandemic because of the international tension that we, the public and the media, foisted upon literally anything that was written about COVID-19. So again, you know, everything that happened in 2020 is a reflection of everything that came before. And it is truly impossible, I think, to deeply understand what has happened this year and what the pandemic meant and what it will mean for us going into the future if we don't understand all of those societal and historical factors that have shaped the experience this year.
It also just speaks to the absolute like vastness and ubiquity of this virus and its impact that like you can answer that question from so many different vantage points. You know, it's like, here's what exposed about society, about our politics, about our media, about the way that science is structured. I mean, it's almost like there's nothing that it didn't touch.
Yeah. And in many ways, my entire body of work this year has really been a vast attempt to answer that question in lots of different ways. And I think the question really is, what does the COVID-19 pandemic say about our soul?
Well, forgive me for this, but what does it say about yours? Like, what have you learned about yourself in this?
That I'm terrible at self-care? I think it's definitely made me ask new questions about what journalism is capable of doing and what types of journalism matter in moments of crisis. I didn't think at the start of this year, or even when I came back from book leave, that this is the type of work I would be doing. I didn't, you know, if you said to me in mid-March, what you're going to do for the rest of the year is to write 8 magazine-length features and 12 or 13 other big feature-length stories and nothing else about one thing, I would probably have laughed. It has made me rethink like how I self-describe. So rather than just a science journalist, I've said repeatedly throughout the year that I think this is much more of a science story and that many of my like MVP sources are not like the traditional people who I would have talked to in the past for the type of work I used to do. There's a lot more historians, anthropologists, sociologists. I've deeply loved knowing more about those fields of expertise. I've been grateful that I haven't broken, but I do feel very close to it. It has been I've said this a couple of times now during this interview, but it has felt like a very brutal exercise. And I haven't, you know, I took 1 week off at the end of July, which was great. I tried to take another week off at the end of September, and in the middle of it, Trump got COVID. So
what was your reaction when that news broke?
It's not fit for podcasting. It just feels like part of a trend for 2020, you know, like 2020 is not content to lay you onto the floor. It will absolutely kick you in the groin while you're down there. And there's something about like the relentlessness of it. You know, I think I said that like I haven't broken, but I have come close. And I think the last couple of months have been especially ruinous for my mental health because I've been staring at the sun for 9 solid months. And because some of the more recent stories I've done have been about healthcare workers in particular and much of what they are experiencing and many of the stories that they have told me are horrifying. You know, people have talked about experiencing so much death that they don't even know how to process it, like seeing death when they go home, having to emotionally shut down because they can only zip up so many body bags. The scope of the tragedy in the healthcare system right now is truly astonishing. You know, I could say the same thing for many of the long haulers I've talked to, you know, people who are still struggling with debilitating ongoing symptoms 8, 9, 10 months into this, who are now facing in the coming months the 1 year anniversary of being sick, who are struggling to access disability benefits or get any kind of medical support at all, and who are now seeing this sort of wave of new people who will likely join their ranks in the near future. It's a lot, and it is difficult work, not just holding in the full scope of this crisis in the kind of journalistic-y make sense of it all way that we've already talked about, but just to actually stare the full scope of the tragedy in the face, that has just been devastating. I'm sort of hesitant to think about like how much to say about it, because on the one hand, I don't want to sort of be melodramatic about what I'm experiencing relative to all the other groups that have also had a very difficult year. But I think in the interest of like being open about mental health stuff, I do not sleep well on more nights than I sleep well. Mm. I am not depressed, but I have experienced depression before in my life, and I know what that feels like, and I can see that coming. And it feels, I don't know, I need a break. So I'm actually going back on book leave in January for a few months, just to take a little time away from the pandemic to kind of recoup my reserves and try and like regain a bit more resilience, which has been sort of badly lost this year. It probably says a lot about what 2020 has been like and about the current state of my mental health that the idea of writing half a book in 4 months it feels like going to a spa, Max. It feels like a radical act of self-care. Like writing a book.
Take an easy crash on a book.
That's right. Writing a book, famously a restorative and deeply relaxing activity. I can't wait.
Oh, man, I got to say, I appreciate you sharing that, because I do think that people don't talk about the mental health impacts of this kind of work very often. And I think particularly, you know, people who have seen you have the year you just had, you know, I mean, your work this year was ubiquitous. You were standing on that platform for the biggest and most difficult story to tell that most of us have lived through, I think. And to know that while that was happening, it was having a real impact on you, I think that's pretty important to say out loud.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I want to say two things about this. So the first thing I wanted to say about this is that I realized a couple of days ago that a lot of the sources I have spoken to, you know, like a lot of the public health folks, sociologists, scientists, all the people who've been thinking about this for the same amount of time have been thinking about it and longer, I've seen a lot of them talk about how their camaraderie with each other has provided a massive source of comfort in this very difficult year. That even when, you know, they're getting harassed at work, or when people are calling them doom-mongers, you know, sliding into their DMs, whatever, the fact that they have found new colleagues, have found new collaborations, has made a huge difference to their mental health. And I have a little bit of that. Like I said, the Atlantic newsroom is very generative. My wife is immense as an intellectual co-conspirator and a sounding board for ideas. Many of her ideas are reflected in my work. But I definitely don't get that same camaraderie, because as the journalist, even for the sources I actually really like and love talking to, I don't get to be their friend, right? Like, I don't get to, like, have the Zoom calls or like chat with them and share like the war stories about how bad everything is. I have to deal with that myself because of that tension that we always have to maintain with our sources. So like a lot of the folks who have actually, I think, gone through the most similar experiences to me this year are also the ones who I don't really get to talk with about it other than through interviews. And that, I think, is hard in a way that I hadn't really thought about until like maybe a couple of days ago.
Do those interviews ever like get to a point where they stop being informational and start being like commiserating in some way?
Like, rarely. I try not to let them get to that point. I mean, a little bit, right? Like when you actually are on the same wavelength as people,
you know, and you're both, like, my favorite interviews are the ones where the source and I are actually engaged in a little bit of a communal attempt to make sense of what is going on. You know, I feel really good when I get to, like, interpret what someone has just said to me and say, does that sound right? And they go, yeah, that sounds really right. And then they can sort of riff off of that. I think
sort of like thinking out loud together.
Yes, I really enjoy that. In fact, that, like, the reporting is actually the part of this that I most enjoy. Like, actually that sense of real-time sense-making with other people who are in the thick of this is very fulfilling. And it sort of helps to take my head out of that very difficult headspace. But, you know, I did talk to a woman named Jessie Gold, who is a psychiatrist who specifically deals with healthcare workers, the mental health of healthcare workers. And I was asking her about the mental health of healthcare workers, and a lot of what she said was basically directly relatable to me. And, you know, it's very hard at that point to remember, like, okay, I'm not, this is not like my therapy session. I'm doing a job here. But, you know, she did say stuff that I've really thought about. And one of them is, it's very easy in the middle of a crisis to sort of explain away what you're feeling and to say, of course I'm feeling anxious or stressed, or, you know, of course I can't sleep, because everyone can't sleep. It's a pandemic. But she suspects that after healthcare workers get past this big surge, that's when a lot of them are going to sit back and suddenly realize, like, oh shit, I need help.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels very relatable. Like, I feel like even now at this point, when, like, I have just filed my last story for the year, I know I'm going into book leave, I can sense that feeling of this very long, deep exhale and suddenly realizing, like, I'm in a bit of a state right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like you've just been keeping that at bay for the better part of a year.
Right. Like, you know, you're just running and running and running this long marathon, and then you get to the end and you suddenly realize, like, oh, look, my legs fell off on mile 18. Who'd have thunk it? Okay. So, and then you mentioned the work I've done and how well it's been received. So that's been really interesting, because I think that the attention to the pieces I've written has been just an order of magnitude higher to anything I've done before. And that's felt both very gratifying. Like, I know that the work is making a difference to readers' lives. I know that it has sort of changed the narrative about long haulers, which I'm very proud of. I know that it has had an impact, but it's also felt weird. So Delia Kai interviewed me for her newsletter, D's Links.
It's a fantastic interview and newsletter. People should check it out.
Yeah, I mean, subscribe to Delia's newsletter. It's so, so great, especially for, like, the listeners of this podcast.
Yeah.
You'll love it. D-E-E-Z Links. And I said to her that it's like Ed Yong has become a character in this season of pandemic, whom I only occasionally write for and play, and now bizarrely have to live up to. So, like, the fact that the work has this recognition and that I have this newfound recognition is great, but it also creates pressure. It creates pressure to, like, constantly get things right. So I have, like, baseline a somewhat anxious personality anyway. Like, I worry a lot about the quality of the work and whether it's good and accurate and whether, you know, just done the reporting well enough. And, you know, I said to Delia on a newsletter, I came into journalism in a slightly sideways route. I started a blog and then did a bit of freelancing and then sort of got into this. So I've always felt a little bit like always a tinge of imposter syndrome, which is, you know, wild when I now am in a situation like this of being, like, a recognized pandemic reporter. I remember seeing someone say, like, tweet a piece of mine about 3 months ago, saying something like, another Ed Yong piece, he doesn't miss. And when I see stuff like that, I don't think, oh, great, job's done. I think that person is going to be mad when I miss next time.
Right. When I inevitably miss.
Like, better not screw up.
Yeah.
Like, how intense is the backlash going to be when the miss happens? So, yeah, there's been that pressure. I do think that one thing I've tried to resist very hard this year has been... So I think we have...
we don't need to name names. Like, everyone listening to this can think of multiple examples of people who suddenly got a bigger platform, fancied themselves an expert on everything, and then just started weighing in on like every possible aspect of the pandemic. Like, people who suddenly got epidemiology degrees in spring and then immunology degrees in summer and are now experts on like vaccine implementation by the winter. I am not those people, and I don't want to be them. I'm very, very clear that I am a journalist and not a pundit, and that the value of my work comes through reporting rather than opining. And I've just tried to hold to that throughout the year, even as the work gets more prominence and recognition. I want readers. I don't want fans. Like, I don't think that helps me or anyone. It doesn't feel like it's a motivator to do better work. I'm glad that people are, you know, reacting to it and finding value in it. But I think that the way it should work is that I should be judged based on the quality of the writing, rather than to get to a point where the writing is judged based on who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want people to think like, this is an amazing piece just because it has my byline on it. Like, that is a path to, I think, arrogance and sloppier work and acting like a diva and all of the things we see among like the many of the worst exemplars of our profession. I want to focus on the work. I want to use whatever extra recognition or prominence I have this year to try and lift as many people up as possible. You know, if I have accrued a ton of social capital in 2020, I've got to spend it because there are so many people who are also doing amazing work.
Mm.
And like, I know well enough how this industry works to be clear that recognition isn't just a factor of quality. Like, we aren't in a meritocracy. It also comes down to so many other things like luck and privilege, the kind of newsrooms that we find ourselves fortunate enough to, or unfortunate enough to be in. So I sort of feel like the more attention on the pieces that I've written, the more the need to make sure those pieces are solid and also to like give back to the community.
Man, that feels like such a wildly healthy approach, Ed.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's in some ways, it's not healthy for me because it does add like extra burden on top of all the stuff we've discussed. But I think that's how I get out of this with my integrity intact.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, one of the other things about this year is that I feel like it's reinforced the idea for me that like opposing things can both be true, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to hear you sort of describe like on the one hand feeling like real imposter syndrome still, and on the other hand, acknowledging that the work is having a huge impact. And it sounds to me like what you're describing is sort of like finding the middle ground between those two things.
Yeah, I think that's right. Someone asked me like how I was feeling, I think after like the first big cover story came out, someone who I've known for a while asked me like how I felt to go from like writing weird nature stories to this like massive blockbuster magazine piece. And it was, I think I said, I hate it, but I want more. Right? Like, I don't want to sound ludicrous about this. Like, of course, like, it's nice to see your peers recognize your work. And it's especially nice, I think, having the work be shared because that's what I most want. But it is a strange feeling. And I think it is like, I felt this tension throughout the year. Like, I think it's very easy to lose yourself amidst that. And it feels like it takes actual effort to not do that.
I got a couple more questions before I let you go.
Yeah, sure.
One of them is, you've been talking to people throughout the course of the year who are either close to the White House or severely impacted by what the White House was doing. And it felt to me like in your work, Trump was always there, but never the central character, like never the point. Kind of. And I wonder what it's been like to talk to people who are working as hard as they are and watching America fail in the way that it did.
Yeah, I think it's been devastating. I don't think even the most seasoned public health people,
the ones who had genuinely thought about pandemic preparedness and really warned about all of this truly expected the magnitude of the failure. You know, obviously the people 1 degree of separation away from Trump feel that strongly. But I think that effect cascades, you know, it cascades all the way down to people at local public health departments, many of whom have been harassed and threatened and doxxed and all the rest of it. And I think that sense of moral injury of trying to fight this crisis while other people are gaslighting you, are denigrating you, has been intense. And I am really worried about this, not just now, but in the long term. I think that a lot of healthcare workers are going to retire or burn out, or, I mean, some of them have died, but I think some of them will just throw their hands up and walk away. I think some public health people will do the same, you know, from exhaustion. I think from the moral ruin of seeing everything they hold dear be taken in vain and sort of be fought against. I think what you said, though, about how Trump is sort of like this lurking figure in the background of a lot of the pieces I've written, and then occasionally like rises to a central prominent role, I think that's right. And I think that is a specific choice of framing. I do not think that Donald Trump is the single answer to why America has done so badly with this pandemic. I think he is an inextricable part of the country's failures. But I think any historical or analytical attempt to look at everything that's happened and ask how did it come to this, any attempt that only looks at Donald Trump or maybe even centers Donald Trump, I think has the wrong thesis and is ignoring other things that we still need to fix come January 21st of next year.
If the lasting impact of this on healthcare workers is that many of them are going to throw their hands up and walk away, what do you think the lasting impact on your work is going to be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't actually know. I'm hoping to use some of this break, some of this 4-month spa trip when I'm writing a book, to think hard about that question, right? So in some respects, I don't have to have an answer by the time I get back because, you know, the pandemic will still be happening in the spring, right? So we'll still be in the middle of the vaccination rollout campaign. And I think that the healthcare worker issue is part of many different issues that will leave long-term scars upon this country. And part of the reason I want to take this break now rather than, I don't know, when I get vaccinated or when hopefully we start getting towards herd immunity and reaching some sense of normalcy. I think the reason why I want to do that now is so that I can be fresh to reach the period where we start getting towards normal, but there are still a lot of lessons to learn. And I think when we get to that point, the propensity to forget and to sweep things under the rug, to, you know, have the details of this year be subsumed within the momentum of vaccination and the elision of history, I think that pull will be very intense. And I hope to be able to think about stories at that point that ask, like, no, but really, like, what did we learn from this? Like, are we going to do better the next time? And I think that someone still has to continue banging that drum. I hope that I won't have to do that, like, as relentlessly as this year.
So maybe not 8 features a year, but you're going to be on this story for a long time.
I think so. I think the story will demand it. You know, before COVID-19 happened, other than the big 2018 feature I wrote for The Atlantic, like many of the infectious disease related stories I wrote basically just sank without a trace. You know, people aren't interested. I think that will change, but I think that what this year has shown is the value of covering those topics, even when they're not foremost on people's minds.
Well, Ed, it's been an unfathomable year.
Yes.
It feels like it's been about 10 years since we last talked. And I feel like as we wrap this up, I sort of want to play for you the way that we ended this conversation in March.
Okay.
Can I just play something for you quickly?
Us in March? Like those young whippersnappers.
I know.
They didn't know.
Well, here I'm going to play something that you said in March, and I just wonder, this is my last question, what you'd say to this guy, March Ed.
Right, okay.
About what was coming.
That guy. Okay, yeah, let's hear it.
I do feel ready. I feel up to the task. I think it's going to be hard, but I hope it's enough. I don't know if it will be, but I think I feel, at the very least, I feel confident that I can do my best.
Oh, God. I think I did do my best. I think I can say that I did my best, and that I do think that the training that I had as a science writer and as an Atlantic writer really helped. I think that youngin, that sweet summer child, had no idea truly what... You know, I did listen to that interview again in preparation for this, and I think I said, oh, yeah, you know, the Atlantic and I agreed that I would take like a month off book leave. And here we are in December. I will say that my wife and I watched the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy again this Christmas, this holiday season. And I have never related to The Hobbit so thoroughly as this watching. They took a whole new symbolism. Bilbo just wants to write his fucking book and keeps on getting dragged into this ridiculous quest. Frodo and Sam on that like rock at the end of Return of the King, just surrounded by fire. Frodo's like, I can't taste strawberries anymore. I don't remember the smell of grass. Yeah, it all feels, it felt a little close to the bone.
Yeah, I can imagine. You left book leave for a month and found the story of your life.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And, you know, it's come at a cost, but it has also been tremendously rewarding. And I really hope that it has made a difference and that it continues to make a difference.
Ed, thank you for your work this year. Thank you for doing not one, but two interviews with me.
Oh, thank you.
Take care of yourself, man.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer, and our intern is Susan Peterson. Thanks to them. Thanks to our friends at MailChimp, who made 2020 possible for the Longform podcast. They're going to make 2021 possible for the Longform podcast. And speaking of 2021, we will be back with new episodes in 2021. We're going to take a couple weeks off, put some of our favorite episodes back through the feed. Have a good break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.